Hello and welcome to the podcast, 10 Lessons That Took Me 50 Years to Learn, where we dispense wisdom to an international audience of rising leaders. In other words, in this podcast, you'll hear valuable insights that you cannot learn from a textbook because it took us 50 years to learn this stuff. My name is Jeffrey Wang, the founder of Professional Development Forum and your host. This podcast is sponsored by the Professional Development Forum, which helps diverse young professionals of any age to find fulfillment in the modern workplace. We're excited to be joined by Narelle Hooper. Narelle is the editor-in-chief at the Australian Institute of Company Directors magazine and is a non-executive director of the Ethics Centre, formerly the editor of AFR Boss, Australia's premier leadership management magazine. She has worked across print, broadcast, and digital media for the biggest media companies in Australia, including AFR, BRW, ABC Radio News and Current Affairs, SBS TV, and Medium Rare Content Agency. In 2015, she co-authored New Women, New Men, New Economy on how sustainable leadership drives performance and innovation. And she also co-founded AFR's 100 Women of Influence Awards. Welcome, Narelle.
Thank you very much, Jeffrey, and thanks for taking the time to interview me. I'm fascinated to see how it's going to emerge.
Well, now we're very excited to have you, Narelle. To call you a trailblazer would be an understatement.
Oh, I'm blushing already. Thank you.
Let's just jump right into it then. Let's start with the very first business lesson that you've learned.
My very first business lesson was a painful lesson. I had a background as a cadet journalist and I'd just been appointed to a new role, which meant jumping a couple of pay grades to a technology magazine in Sydney. And I went up, put my best clothes on, went off for the interview in Sydney and sat down and they were going to hire me. And then we got to talking about pay and they said, right, so what were you expecting when it comes to your pay? And I, of course, immediately blabbed, I wanted to be a grade up from where I was. So it was something like a B grade, for example, at the time. And they went, right, sounds fair enough. And I got the job and I got the pay. And I did manage to work in a 3-month transition and kind of review period. But I found out later that they were prepared to pay me 2 pay grades above what I'd nominated. So wow. I had immediately done myself out of probably 20, 25 grand. And it was an enduring lesson about just keep your mouth shut when someone asks you to name the first dollar figure in a negotiation or in the parlance, the kind of negotiating language is don't open first. And I'm really lucky I got the 3 months review in because at that point I kind of realized my mistake and I managed to get the increase. But 3 months at whatever the lack of money was, I paid for it over time.
Don't open first. There you go. All right. Well, let's jump into something that you have unlearned. So what have you unlearned? What I mean by that is something that you believe absolutely to be true when you started your career, but you have found out later that that's not the case.
Oh, wow. There's a number of lessons. There's one in particular, I think, that was a big lesson. And that is when you set out on your career and you've got aspirations, and you've got kind of stars in your eyes and you've got your aim, you've got your kind of goals that you set. And very often there are things like, my first car or my first house or, I'd like this handbag or whatever the nice piece of equipment and shiny stuff is that you set your gaze on. And that's all very fine. But I've come to realize over time, the stuff, you forget about that pretty quickly. You might have some short-term satisfaction in that. It doesn't add up over time. And those deeper investments that you save up for and make, they stand you in really good stead. But don't fuss about the shiny stuff and the brand name watch or the brand name shoes or the brand name handbags or clothes or, the best stuff on the street or whatever. You'll save yourself some money about that, but it also, you come to realize it's a projection. It's not a reflection of your inner self. Fundamentally, it's much more important to get focused of an internal sense of satisfaction and then your relationships with other people. That was a really important one. There was a secondary lesson around that which I've learned later, which is to learn to listen. Very often, once you've got the gift of communication, it's really tempting to fill the spaces and to talk a lot. But the art of listening, and I mean like really listening, is gold.
Okay, so don't chase the shiny stuff and learn to listen. I like where this is heading already. All right, so on your list, you mentioned everyone need to feel like they belong. Now, we all kind of know that, but what do you really mean by that?
So a sense of belonging, it's a sense of welcoming people. And I mean, that comes at an individual level and a organizational level and a national and international level. But I just want to back up a bit and just talk a bit about how it came to be an important value for me. I grew up in country in New South Wales, out near Millthorpe and Orange. And it's Wurundjeri country of First Nations people. My family had not had a lot, but they'd grown up on a farm, and we had a dairy farm. And my mum and dad worked really hard. My mum actually worked as a maternity sister at the local hospital, and she did night shift for like 12 or 15 years, the poor thing. And my dad, who was a very gregarious and curious person who'd been brought home to run the farm when he probably would have been preferred to be an electronics engineer or something, he wound up buying a pub. So in addition to running a dairy farm, we ran a pub. And so for many, many years, I always remember that there was always a spare bed if anyone needed it. Very often we'd have people staying who were, you know, whatever life circumstances they were going with. And there was always a sense of being made to be welcome and food on the table. And it didn't have to be a lot of food. It was just a generous sharing of what you had. That to me has become a core value. Mm-hmm. And when I went on to be, I was the first one in my family to go to university, went on to study journalism. And in a roundabout way, eventually that brought me to Boss Magazine and the focus on management and leadership. And we'd often have events where I got to meet you, in fact, in the professional development forum. And it was really important to me when we were bringing these older executives together with the younger executives. And there's a lovely energy in that space, but to make people feel welcome, they'd be recognized and kind of acknowledged and included. I still find that it's a good feeling that you have. And yeah. If you think about yourself as an individual when you're going to an event, well, we used to in the days pre-pandemic, right, before we
had people on Zoom. Feels like a lifetime ago.
It does. You'd walk into the room and you might be on your own and you might be feeling a bit awkward and not that confident and so forth. And one little lesson out of that I learned, and I think I learned this probably from some other senior executive, was if you're on your own and you see someone else on their own, just take the time to kind of go up to some other person and just get talking, and you can just kind of make them feel a bit welcome, you feel better, and just include people. I feel that it's a spirit of generosity underpinning that. At a national level, you can have it. You've got to keep secure and look after people, but you equally want to be welcoming to those people that you allow to come into your country and into your home.
And as a former migrant going into a country that it was new to me and not being able to speak much English, I could still remember the way I was made to feel welcome by the people who I met at the time. Now, I was a kid migrating to New Zealand as a 10-year-old. You know, you could just imagine new language, new environment. And yet that generosity just transcends all sorts of barriers, which is just incredible. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned that when you're younger, you had people sleeping over and staying over, and that exposure to so many different types of people with their varying stories and background, that would have really opened your eyes up to, you know, just exactly what the world has to offer, isn't it?
Well, you just reminded me about that. As someone who's had to leave their country and go somewhere else, you've had to take your courage and your, you know, your hope for a better future, and you take all of that in your hands, and you know, you're exposed to whatever life brings to you, but you've taken that step, right? And that's that kind of migrant mentality is actually a really important one for entrepreneurship and so forth. And you sparked a memory. I grew up and went to school, this little country place in Millthorpe, and we had a bunch of kids from, in Millthorpe there were kids from Poland because there were a lot of post-war migrants. And we used to share our lunches. They liked my lunch, which was a bit dull probably, and I loved theirs. And we had Italian kids and some Greek kids as well. That was really a good kind of feeling. When I went to primary and high school in Blaney, I just remembered that there were other kids who were from migrant families and they were not quite in a good position. And some of those kids got shunned in the class. At the time, I didn't know any better about what to do about that, but to this day, I kind of reflect about that and think, how hard must that have been for those kids to get up and go to school and to know that they were going to be treated that way? And I would never want that to happen to anyone that I dealt with. That's just something I just don't think is a good value. But the time you see this behavior, helping kids to understand and have that value of actually you can take some action about that, you can make someone feel welcome, I think would be a good counter to that. It was the kids that were included and the kids that were excluded. And that would have been a really scarring memory for some people. And I wouldn't want that to happen.
No, absolutely. But I like to look at the silver lining in all this, you know, because of how you were able to connect with and across these cultural barriers and the likes, you know, I like to think that because of your ability to have these relationships with people who are so different to yourselves, that would have helped you somewhere in your career, surely.
Ah, well, I've always liked, you know, I love traveling. I love that sense of curiosity. And I mean, it's a journalist quality in many respects, but I think that came from my dad, because even though he was brought back and had to work the farm when he was a people person, right? So he had to end up working with lots of cows. He would have preferred to work with lots of people. But he always had he was always reading widely and always kind of questioning. And then that curiosity about other people and kind of other places and other ways of thinking, that I really like. And it does make for a very busy mind. But it also, in terms of kind of your life, you join lots of dots. And I think there's a real strategic benefit around that. And increasingly, as the world's kind of moved on, it's a way of network thinking that does become, it kind of builds its own momentum in terms of business development and your own career opportunities. Fundamentally, I heard a former SAS Major General speak the other day on an interview, and he was saying, fundamentally, we often talk about the difference, whether I'm, you know, male, female, my racial background, your sexual preferences and so forth. But he said, fundamentally, we're all human, and that's a common element. And that's the thing that really should bring us together, as opposed to what makes us different. I thought that was pretty good.
I absolutely agree with that. So lesson number three, you mentioned take the road less traveled.
Ah, the old, who was that, Scott Peck? Was it the road less traveled? There's a story to this. But after I went to university in what's now Canberra University, and loved journalism and wound up eventually back in the press gallery in Canberra as political correspondent for Business Review Weekly magazine. It was the days of mobiles, but pre-social media. You're operating in Parliament House and, you know, this kind of idea about the pack of journalists people talk about. And you'd hear a story would be in the wind and everybody be charging after that particular story. To do my job properly on a weekly magazine, I had to, when everyone was charging that way, I had to go, why? And question that, right? So, and very often I'd find that the real stories were either in the other direction or in a little dark corner that not everybody else was looking at. Oh. You kind of go and explore something, you kind of just start that question, like, what's going on and why is everyone doing that? What else is happening? So that kind of questioning, I got some really great stories out of that, which ended up being cover stories for the magazine. And to the, you know, I was nominated as a Walkley finalist for a story, which goes back a long way, but that was the questioning. And the other thing that goes with that is actually just observing when there is, and hey, this actually operates in investment bubbles, right? So everyone's in piling in on the share market. You're kind of going, hang on a minute. Like there's a point that you want to maintain that and it's risky to be out of the market. But equally, you kind of go, what's really going on here? And is there something else I should be looking at?
I was just thinking about that, you know, in the age of Twitter and social media and information overload, does this still hold true? Is it groupthink that was happening back then, you know, in the mobile but pre-social media days, is it groupthink worse back then? Or is it in going to hyperdrive right now?
Ah, yeah, good question. So I think it still applies. I think social media has been great for airing perspectives that we might not have heard previously. And sometimes you can see an issue that escalates when people get onto a fact. Mind you, that's a whole other conversation, right? Because of the infodemic, what, you know, real versus imagined facts kind of thing. There is the kind of the social media pylon, like people talk about the pylon on Twitter. Like I really value Twitter for bringing ideas and research reports and perspectives to my attention that I might not have got through my own other sources. But equally, it can be brutal and it can be, I think it was David Penberthy from a columnist I read recently, and he said it can cultivate the mindset, which is I'm right and everyone else is an asshole, excuse the French. It's a pretty harsh old world and it's the judgment is immediate. immediate, not a lot of reflection. And I think taking the time to not join the pylon is to just stop and reflect and think is more valuable and more vital than ever.
So basically lesson number three holds true then. Don't join the pylon. Let's look the other way and see what we're missing.
Yeah, I think that still holds. And it's always good for life, right? In, in the days when we travel. Hey, it's good for Australia now when we can, we're forced to stay at home. So you take the road less traveled in country New South Wales or Queensland. And,
there's so many levels to this lesson, isn't there?
I know, this goes on. I did a trip in August. I took a week off and we did just that. And I met some amazing, lovely local people. And thankfully it had rained a bit and they were in much better spirits than they were the last time I'd been out last year when Earth was baking and the drought seemed to go forever.
Okay, so lesson number four. Now, this might be interesting. You have the power to influence.
It's about, and I learned this through a friend of mine. So the story that she told me was that she was a young executive at a company and she'd been in a meeting with a really famous, management researcher or something. And she'd been in the room and she'd not said a word through this entire meeting. She kind of got out of the meeting and afterwards and just mentioned that she was too terrified to say anything. And he turned to her and he said, "Do you know, you have an impact just by being in that room or at the table, whether you speak or whether you don't speak." We often get so worried about what would happen if we actually spoke or if we talk too much or whatever. But it showed to me that contrast that if you're in the room or you're at the table, you will have an impact. Whether you choose to speak up or to back someone else who's spoken, which I think is a really important element of influencing, or whether you're so self-conscious that you don't speak up, you've got the potential to influence that outcome. And you can either take it and give it a go or you lose the opportunity. I mean, there's an extension with that by not speaking up. Sometimes you become part of the problem, to use the cliche. You can be.
Yeah, I mean, this is a very interesting lesson. I mean, I'm thinking of the context of someone who potentially is not used to speaking up or they may from a culture that speaking up is, not a desirable trait, or they just haven't been raised with the ability to speak up. But what you're saying here, though, is that just by being around the table or being around to support those people that speak up on your behalf, you do have the power that a lot of us don't often perceive that we have.
Well, you've landed on a really important element of that, which is there's cultural differences often, and there's also communication preferences and thinking differences, right? So a really strong and underappreciated element of leadership is to be aware of those potential differences and to make sure that you have genuinely included everyone in the conversation. There's that word again. Inclusion. A couple of really brief examples about that. I was talking about this just today with a colleague of mine. We were doing some communications, we were learning from this. I'd had a good meeting with a guy in this team. He was an engineer. He was a bit more of an introvert. The idea was that one would tell a story and the other would listen and then you'd ask questions and do the reverse. So he was telling me his story and I was making eye contact going, "What? Like, that's really interesting." And I'm, very interested in the story. And I got feedback from him that he found that eye contact too confronting. Right. So that was really interesting to me. So I then just started to observe a bit more and I realized that his way of communicating was actually to drop his eyes a little. And then someone today talking about that, they said that in their community, too much eye contact was viewed as impolite. Right. So,
right.
And then there's that kind of more formal sense of what's appropriate to take into consideration. That was good. And on top of that, some people like to hear, some people are more kinesthetic and kind of feeling in their communication preferences. Some people are a bit more visual and so forth. So just it's been helpful just to kind of appreciate those differences and not to rush to fill the space. The quietest person in the room will very often have the best input. And sometimes we miss that out because we don't give them the time to reflect and bring them into the conversation. That's a kind of agility in terms of being aware of those elements of communications.
All right, lesson number five, look out for landmines.
Oh, yeah.
That sounds like a good story.
Yes, and they're not actual real landmines. They're political kind of power, dynamic landmines that can make or break your influence. The story with that goes, that was a time where I wasn't aware of the politics in the organisation. So, there's always the politics that goes on. Sometimes they can be constructive and kind of just knowing there's the formal power structures, but there's the kind of how decisions are really made Like, I wish there was a lesson when you're in high school that they could just teach you all this stuff so you don't discover it and trip over landmines in your life. For a period of time, I'd been at the ABC and then I'd moved over to a role at SBS TV. And there was a particular event that happened with the journalist and the organisation wound up in the industrial relations as an issue. There was a bit of public scrutiny on this, and our little team of the people who'd kind of been involved had been affected by this. We were quite upset about things, so we had a form of communicating what our views were, and I found out later we'd actually really embarrassed the management. There could have been a better way to handle that. We were just so blindly concerned with what we felt about it, we didn't think about how to best influence the situation. I learned to my cost in that situation, so we weren't a team any longer at the end of that. But it was a really good lesson in terms of just really being aware of the politics, not necessarily buying into them, but there's a way of influencing. And very often you can quietly influence things behind the scenes and kind of doing the work to understand that, as opposed to being so passionately caught up in the rightness of your issue that you're not aware of what other potential concerns there are around you.
So what would you have done instead? Like, if you had to do that again, what would you have done?
I wouldn't have written a letter to the editor of a national newspaper along with my co-workers. I would have handled that in a much quieter internal way. I would have attempted to have resolved the issue that way before I'd kind of taken it. Well, what do they talk about? You kind of go to force Chen straight away as opposed to exhausting the various options of influencing. But like, I survived. I got a few scars. It was a really valuable lesson that I've just kept that in mind. So sometimes you can just not be alert to what's going on. The power dynamics of every organisation, I mean, that's how things get done or not done. And learning and understanding the influence, that's really a helpful thing. You often hear people say, oh, I don't like the politics and everything. And I'm not talking about being overly political, but it's about influence, right?
But I wonder if there's a way to learn such ways without really incurring a few scars on the way.
Yeah, well, I think you're right about the scars, but I think that's why having an older mentor are kind of people who have war stories or they've knocked a bit of bark off along the way. And those kind of older heads, it's always good to have someone like that around, and you can test your thinking at the time. Kind of growing up that way, we didn't really talk about mentors or having that kind of support, and you either lucked on it or you didn't. For a long time, I kind of really didn't luck on it. And then I realized I kind of had a couple of quiet mentors and just people who could kind of give you a really hard-headed view of what the world is really, you know, what's really going on here, and asking a couple of tough questions. And then just realizing you can actually tap in those people. It's kind of like having a little personal board of advisors, informal people to help guide you on the way, I think.
And failing that, you've always got this podcast.
Absolutely, yes.
All right, number six. Now, I love this one. It sounds like you're traveling a lot. Put on your oxygen mask before helping others.
So that advice in the days when we were flying more frequently, it's a good one, right? It's not about putting yourself first, but you often think about, like, I care passionately and I've got a strong sense of social justice, a strong sense of wanting to leave the world in a slightly better shape than I'd found it and so forth. I think sometimes we can be so caught up in those matters that we lose sight of the fact that it all starts at home. It starts with you. So you can be, you know, off saving the world when maybe you need to also pay a bit of attention to your neighbours and those in your family. And I think you start with that circle, like you're making sure that you've got, not being a kind of, you know, someone's trying to save the world and having really dysfunctional personal relationships, or, you know, if you're not sleeping right at night, then it's telling you something's not quite right. But just being aware of that. And I reckon during the lockdown period, I live in an apartment block near a park, and we've always known our neighbours reasonably well, but we got a lot closer to our neighbours, the people in the street. We'd see them every day, kind of all walking out, trying to get their exercise. We started saying hello, whereas we mightn't have. We were so busy kind of going from A to B previously that we didn't even very often bother to say hello. So just that little, you know, just dropping off some food for someone, or just asking, checking in on someone, or leaving a sign just saying, look, you know, if anyone needs anything. I think over the last 30 or 40 years, we've succeeded a lot. There's been a lot of economic development, but very often it's kind of hollowed out the local communities.
I've noticed that, haven't I? Like, we're talking about global issues like climate change, but yet charity starts at home. And I think we kind of missed a bit of the local community. I mean, even if it's just, you know, a local Christmas hamper drive or even, you know, a local car wash, a sausage sizzle and all that. I do think that there is a bit of that being lost while we try to worry about big issues that you lose your personal. But I like to just touch on another point that you mentioned about sleeping. So how much of that is also self-care as well? I mean, the thing is, you can only help others when you're in a position to, you know, I could only imagine if a person's exhausted and tired and sick, you know, you're not in a position to help anyone else.
Yeah. I went to a lunch a few years ago and the Dalai Lama was speaking. Of course, everyone, you know, it was full of a lot of middle-class professionals like myself. And, you know, we're all curious to hear what the Dalai Lama had to say. And someone asked about, you know, what's the best advice kind of thing. He said, so how is your sleeping? And the woman said, oh, not very good. He said, first, you need a good sleep. And it went on, the conversation went on. But he said, if your sleep is disrupted, you're not getting the rest that you need, right? In order for your brain and your body to function properly, you do need to get a reasonable amount. You need to rest, right? Understanding now more about neuroscience, we know we need to give our brains a good rest. If you're not sleeping well, and if you're eating well and kind of just caring for yourself, and I don't mean, you know, you're so obsessed that you're not doing anything else, but just a level of self-care, like, our physical bodies are what carry us around, right?
That's right.
And just being careful to kind of look after them and basic maintenance and care, like you would for whatever vehicle you either drive around, or be it a scooter or a bike or a, yeah, whatever.
That's it. Wise words.
A little anecdote about that is that while I was working in Parliament House in the press gallery, and my dad died at that point, and I did a lot of self-reflection then, and I wound up, someone had introduced me to yoga, and I wound up kind of going, this is really interesting. So I wound up studying to be a yoga teacher. And I've, like, to this day, that's one of the best pieces of education I ever did, because it teaches you about philosophy. It teaches you about there are times you just can't control the world and you've just got to submit to events, and also to be kind and gentle with people.
Number 7, respect those who came before you. This sounds pretty profound. Are we talking generations? Are we talking civilizations? What are we talking about?
So growing up in country New South Wales, we knew a lot about the kind of local history and the gold rush and farmers came out and everything. And, you know, a lot of the things we didn't hear about, like very often the women's stories were really quiet in that. But more than that, the story of the people who lived in that area before the coming of the European settlement was so rarely told, right? So I didn't know a lot about Wiradjuri country and, you know, what went on there when it was settled in the kind of 1830s or thereabouts. And that history, I think we're the poorer for not knowing about that history and about that, the great traditions of the First Nations people. So there's that element. And then I went to the Garma Festival up in Arnhem Land about 10 years ago. You sit in the Yolngu people are incredibly welcoming, and they come and you sit in the dust and you don't say much for a while and you just kind of be. But you understand that kind of wisdom and that travels together over, you know, generations is really quite deeply profound. And it's a respect for land and people and the resources. That element, I think, is important. And then within that is your sense that your parents and your grandparents before that. And that, so there's that element that you're walking this way for the period of time that you're on the earth for however long that is. And then after that, you know, after the job you're doing, someone else might come along, or after you've gone, you know, and your kids or whatever, someone else comes after that. So it's just a way of being really aware that your time is a limited time. Have awareness of that in terms of your actions, and something will come after you.
Yeah.
And that's the way, you know, it's like the way it works.
Yeah, no, I can certainly identify with that. I suppose in ancient Chinese wisdom, it's just knowing how small our time frame reference is in the greater context of history and civilizations and the like. So I can certainly identify with that. But it sounds to me like this is related to number 8, try to do no harm. I like that word, try.
Well, the doctors have that first do no harm is kind of basic element of the Hippocratic Oath. Growing up as a kid, I used to have kind of slightly wild and a household where everyone had high spirits, high tempers. You get really angry. There was often an element of you were walking on eggshells sometimes because we were never quite sure what mood our dad would be in, right? You know, there's a level of issues around family violence that I still to this day it's important for me that women and men speak up about these issues. But first, do no harm in family circumstances. But around that, my thinking is to try to leave a positive wake. Mm. So, and when I talk about wake, if you take the kind of metaphor to water, you know, we'd have these big loud arguments in the family and then it would all be forgotten, right? And then we just kind of go on and whatever. When I got married, my husband's family was, they had a different way of dealing with things. They'd get upset, but they wouldn't talk about it, right? So people would be walking on eggshells because they weren't quite sure what everybody was feeling, but no one would talk about it, right? So the idea of the wake you're creating is that you don't want it to be so choppy. You know, you want the excitement and fun and love and joy and so, but you don't want to leave it so crapped out behind you that it's really hard for someone coming behind you. And I quite like the idea of, even if it's just an interaction with someone in the street, or I know you've got to very often do work that's not savory, or you've got to get an outcome that's uncomfortable, but it's still to make it a positive interaction. Does that make sense?
Is it a case of being kind in general?
Do you see that as a bit of a pay it forward, starting a movement and sending out good vibes per se? Or is it more of a case of whatever situation you find yourself in, it's about making the most of what you've got?
Yeah, I think both those apply actually. Mm. Remember they had, it was like the kindness kind of movement where you could actually have a little card and you could leave the card behind with someone else saying, I've done a nice thing for you. Maybe you could do a nice thing for someone else. I'm not sure we all need to do that, but it's a little gesture of kindness. You know, it might be just saying hello to someone in the street, or it might be not ignoring the homeless person who's asking for money, or but just saying hello to them, or just a little gesture or something. And it's, again, I think that kind of comes back to that notion you've got some influence just by being in the world. So if you can make it a good experience for other people, I don't mean like I sounds a bit like Pollyanna, right? But I don't mean to be quite like that. But I don't want to leave an experience where someone feels was really negative. You know, if you've got to do some tough negotiation or whatever, you still want to make it you can walk away and respect the outcome.
And then I like to think that maybe there's a butterfly effect that amplifies whatever it is that you've done.
Yeah.
You know, something good that you could leave behind, but eventually it creates great things in the future because of someone paying all that forward.
I caught up with my neighbour on the weekend. So we're coming up to Christmas in Australia and we had a little gathering for our apartment block and someone brought a lovely cake and it was called a friendship cake. And I went, oh, it was hot, came out of the oven. It was really yummy. And I said, this is just lovely. Can I have the recipe? And she said, oh, even better. I've made a starter for this cake and I'll share some of that with you. So I'm the inheritor of the friendship cake. Now I'm going to feed that every couple of days. And in a couple of weeks, I'll make another cake. And then I've got to find five other people to give them the bits to. I don't know how long I'm going to keep this friendship cake going.
That's actually a really original idea. Love that.
There's your butterfly.
All right. Well, number 9, don't lose your connection with nature. Now, this must have been something because you grew up on the farm, I'm guessing.
Yeah. So we worked pretty hard on the farm. I'd get up, my job in the morning before I went to school was to get up really early and round up the cows. It'd be really frosty in winter or beautiful in summer, but the morning is the best part of the day. And just getting out in nature, whether you're going for a walk, you know, you can just see some plants or trees or sky or whatever. I found it a very nurturing element. During the lockdown, when some places they weren't even allowed outside, right? In Sydney, we were at least allowed to go for a walk and get some exercise in the day. And I was lucky enough to have a park nearby and then the botanical gardens. So just to go and be in that space, we are fundamentally from nature, that it's a very healing space. Sometimes when you're feeling, you know, a bit tired and a bit irascible and like you've had not a very good time or week or year or whatever, just getting out, being in the park or going for a walk and getting some air, I think it's a really healing thing. Mm-hmm. And I think that we've had a period of time where very often nature has suffered because we've got the great work of capitalism, which has lifted hundreds of millions of people out of poverty, but we've externalized the cost on that and nature suffers because very often we don't put a value on it. There's kind of work afoot now to do that and value our natural capital. But in the meantime, we've got a bit of restoring work to do on that. Ostensibly, you know, we know climate change is an issue that it's clear and present danger and we've got to deal with it. But around that also is that fundamentally by bringing more of nature into our lives and our world, it does make us better. It doesn't mean you've got to go out. What's that show? I'm a celebrity, get me out of here, but they all go out the crazy jungle. I don't mean that.
It's living in harmony with nature, I think, is
Yeah,
the
we're going to
real.
have to find that's kind of one of the macro trends. I like in kind of the work I do. I do get to kind of look at the larger trends that are driving society and the economy. And that, yes, responding to climate risk is a fundamental. That macro trend about nature is a really important one. We're starting to see organizations, you're seeing the kind of buildings now where they're being designed, where they're drawing in elements of nature into, might be plants down the side of the building. Biomimicry is a kind of element of that. We look to nature for inspiration in constructing materials and structures for the man-made world.
The last lesson, and probably my favorite lesson, always have good hair and shoes. Yeah, it makes sense to me, but I'd love to hear it from yourself.
All right, so this was a bit tongue in cheek, but working in TV and then very often doing the kind of public interviews that I've done, you do learn that we're all judged by our appearance, rightly or wrongly, but we are judged. And I think, what do they say? It's you've got about 1 to 3 seconds and you make up your mind about someone. And in TV in particular, women are judged very harshly on their image. And very often on telly, I'd be doing a really interesting discussion panel and then you get feedback from the audience saying, what are those earrings she's wearing? Why did she wear that top? And we need to move on from that and just accept people who are professional and well-crafted and communicate well and so forth. So I always thought if whatever goes wrong, provided you've got good hair, people will forgive a lot. And I just mean being neat and well-presented, right, about around that. And the issue around shoes, and if you're fortunate enough to have feet to put your shoes on, it's just nice, neat shoes. So being professionally well-turned out doesn't have to be expensive, just good quality and neat. And it's a really basic thing, but I always just used to say, oh, whatever happened today, at least I had good
That's right. That's very good value advice. And thank you so much for taking your time out to speak with us today. I've always admired how you've treated others and those around you. From our interactions when we first met, when I was running Professional Development Forum, and when you're at Boss Magazine, and I can certainly see a lot of the values that you've carried throughout your careers that's got to where you got to today. So really appreciate that and the advice that you've given us.
Well, thank you, Jeffrey. And I've just so admired the work that you do with the Professional Development Forum. It's been great to know you over the years. And I want to thank you. Like, this, it's such a cool idea. So thank you. And thanks to the people who are listening and watching. And I really appreciate it. And I hope it's been some help. And I've learned heaps as well.
Thank you.
All the
Thank you.
best. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
You have been listening to the international podcast, 10 Lessons It Took Me 50 Years to Learn, produced by Robert Hostry and sponsored by the Professional Development Forum. PDF provides webinars, social media discussions, podcasts, parties, anything you want, anything you need. For more information, please visit www.professionaldevelopmentforum.org. Oh, and did I mention that it's all free? Thank you for listening and stay safe, everyone.